You're listening to a podcast from 702.
This hour, we have a look at biases within artificial intelligence and machine learning. I'm very excited about this. We have, you and I, often, and we do so quite a lot in the show, talk about different kinds of biases, and we have to, because we need to live in a more just society, and that means a society in which we eliminate bias. But we don't often talk about bias in relation to technology. And I think part of it is because we just sort of interact with technology unconsciously, actually very often, until someone comes along and in a popular piece of writing tells you, hey, did you know that coding is not necessarily innocent? AI is not necessarily innocent. And then suddenly we have to transplant some of our general insights into unconscious and other forms of explicit bias and try and understand what happens inside of technology. And so this is going to be a conversation that's really, we will learn a lot from, and I hope that you will enjoy it. Let me introduce my two guests. First up, I think in Cape Town, she's Dr. Rachel Adams, research specialist at the Human Sciences Research Council and an associate researcher at the Information Law and Policy Center at University of London's Institute for Advanced Legal Studies. Dr. Adams, good morning, and thank you so much for being part of this conversation.
Hi, good morning, Eusebius. It's lovely to be here.
The pleasure is all ours. And then here with me in Johannesburg is Afshin Bachu, who is Chief Technology Officer with PPS Insurance. Dr. Bachu is overqualified for this conversation. I'm looking forward to understanding the technology side of things, what actually the processes are, how people go about, what AI really is. Many of us social science students, we say some of these terms, but what actually goes on inside the world of AI when programs and all sorts of things are built that you and I then interface with as the end users. Afshin, good morning, and thank you for coming to studio.
Good morning, and thank you.
I want to start off with you, and I'm going to ask you some really silly questions from your point of view, but please treat me as a blank slate. Artificial intelligence is something we bandy about those two words quite a bit, including politicians who don't always know what they talk about, or talk show hosts. What is artificial intelligence?
Well, firstly, artificial intelligence, or AI, is not a singular concept. It's a toolbox of different techniques that can be used to solve many types of problems. The definition is therefore contextual to the type of problem that's being solved. AI is used in various things from self-driving cars, robotics, IoT, your Google Home and Alexa, even the email out-of-office settings. So that is what AI is. In other words, it's the ability for computers to learn, gain experience, and then make decisions just like humans. I can give you an example. So when you learn to read, you first learn the alphabets. You then make patterns with the alphabets to form words and then sentences. In a similar way, AI exploits common relationships in data using algorithms. AI simply finds patterns in existing data and then reuses those patterns in other data to make predictions.
Okay. But human beings decide on, presumably, how those patterns should be sought after within information systems, right, and within technology. In other words, what I'm getting at, Afshin, is that sometimes when we talk about AI, it's a little bit like we used to talk about evolution in biology. We make it seem as if there's this person that's not a human being that is called Mr. Evolution.
Yeah.
And the same with AI. AI is some human being or some creature that makes decisions about how to look for patterns and that kind of thing. But of course, machines don't exist without the human beings that are involved in programming and coding. So you, as a programmer or coder, and I'm using terms here wildly interchangeably, correct me when I'm talking nonsense. What is your role when you set out to write, for example, a program that should look for patterns?
Look, many times the programs or the algorithms are fairly generic.
Okay.
The issues or the biasness or biases typically exist within the data. And if you look at data, data can be anything. It's facts, figures, numbers. Data is even models of humans. So many times the biasness exists within the data. It's people's biasness that's within the data. And all that the systems or the algorithms do is that they reflect that biasness.
I want to bring you in here, Rachel. Before we get back to technology, maybe we should hit the pause button and talk about what bias is and why bias is bad. Because if we do not have a agreement about the concept of bias, then we can't make headway in understanding why bias inside artificial intelligence and machine learning is something that should concern all of us as more of our lives become lives that are intertwined with artificial intelligence. What are biases, and why do they matter so profoundly in our world?
Okay, so first of all, I want to start off by saying that bias is not something that can be gotten rid of. It is not something that necessarily produces an unfair outcome. And what we're interested in here is biases that result in unfair discrimination, in somebody not being able to access a loan or access the country or having some material outcome on their life that's unfair, and that maybe if you go back to how that decision was made, whether it was automated or not, that goes back to some kind of social category or social grouping, whether that's in terms of gender or in terms of race. So I think we need to be able to distinguish that. When we collect data, decisions are made at every point in the process, whose data to collect, what categories of data to collect, how to collect it. And in every point that a human decision is made, there is some form of bias. So what we need to look out for is when that bias results in something unfair, or alternatively, where we need to embed certain biases in the system to produce more fair outcomes. Affirmative action, BBBEE, is an example of where we are instilling particular biases in order to produce a more fair outcome.
I find that so fascinating. South Africans deeply disagree about these issues. And unsurprisingly, we tend to disagree along the lines of either being survivors of systemic bias or being beneficiaries of bias and hegemony. I mean, just an hour ago, there was a raging debate about whether the composition of human beings in a photo from Sir Richard Branson should matter to us. Yesterday, there was a debate about whether representativity in political leadership should matter to us, Rachel, or whether we should be colorblind and simply worry about the technical competencies of a leader, or in the case of Richard Branson, the team members at the Center for Entrepreneurship or whatever it's called. Can you explain, if it does matter, why the composition of teams matter? Get away from the race trigger in South Africa. Let's talk gender. If only, or a disproportionate number of persons working on writing algorithms for the bank are men, is that inherently problematic? And if so, why?
Well, I think it's been found to be inherently problematic. So we can look at empirical evidence here as well. So if you look at Silicon Valley, which is where the majority of AI and the majority of this kind of technological innovation is coming from, even if it's not originating precisely from there, here, it's being taken as a kind of international best example and influential standard. So at the moment, less than 20% of executive leadership positions in Silicon Valley are occupied by women. Women graduates of computer science, machine learning researchers are also less than 20%. I think it was at about 18%. But what's more interesting is to track that historically, because in about 30 years ago, just over 30 years ago, in about the 1980s, there used to be a rate of about 35% of graduates from computer science would be women. And now that's dropped off really significantly to a rate of about 18-19%. So we need to look at where these stereotypes are coming from that are pushing women out of science and technology studies, and that obviously later influences the workplace. There hasn't been, from my knowledge, a lot of studies here that have shown how algorithmic processing has been shown to be biased against women in South Africa. there has been a lot elsewhere. So we need to take from those lessons learned, especially mm-hmm. when we're taking their technology.
Mm.
And if you look at the really recent example is the Amazon algorithm that the company used for ranking possible candidates for a job. And what it did, this algorithm was trained on all the historical hiring practices of Amazon, hiring practices that tended to favor men and disfavor women.
Yeah.
And it started to downgrade on this kind of ranking system. Any CV that had the word women or woman or gender, and also anybody that had gone to some of the women's only or women colleges in the US.
Mm.
And because this system was trained on historical data,
mm-hmm.
and any AI is based on historical data, unless you're using synthetic data, which mm-hmm. is a kind of different story altogether. It can't be corrected. The biases can't be corrected. You can't correct history.
Mm.
And so what happened is they just had to leave this system altogether and take affirmative, positive steps to try and include women into their hiring practices and change their hiring practices. Practices to be more beneficial towards women.
That is absolutely fascinating, Afshin. Whether we take the example that Rachel is discussing in terms of hiring practices and how collating big data may have an efficiency gain, but at the cost of perpetuating historical prejudice against women. Well, in the South African context, you know, in the last year, because this is partly what you keep tabs on in your own jobs and careers that you have, how within the financial services sector there have been a criticism that past historical prejudice against the working poor, the indigent, and in South Africa that means black people in particular, how those past biases are reproduced by pretending to have a veneer of objectivity with the systems in the banks that simply collate data about prospective applicants who want to access bank loans, for example. What do you just speak into those two examples? Yeah. Are those exhibit A and B respectively that you and some of your peers are guilty, even if it's unconscious rather than explicit bias?
Look, it does all come down to the data. And if I give you an example, if AI had to select a candidate for a CEO, and if the sample data contains very few females, the AI system will not likely select a female regardless of qualification or experience. This scenario would also apply when selecting a nurse and if the data contains mostly female candidates. So it still boils down to the data. But the way to come around that is to artificially create ethical or unbiased data models and insert that into the overall sample. So there are techniques in place that AI scientists use to overcome some of those biases.
I want to just slightly change tech for one second, right? I mean, you've got a PhD in IT architecture. When we talk about how the programmers are taught, how professionals within IT are taught academically, does this stuff come up at all? Or are you suddenly finding yourself being critiqued in some opinion piece online that says, hey, you and others like you unintentionally perpetuate gender bias or racial bias? I wonder whether or not there's an intersection between the technical core competencies that are taught in these sectors of academic journeys and the kind of really deep moral and political issues that we shouldn't be perpetuating in technology.
Look, I don't believe so. I think the actual algorithms and the programming techniques are fairly generic. It still boils down to the data. Because these algorithms and coding scripts almost sift, sample, and filter data. So it all boils down to the data. So I don't believe so.
But how far does that go? It may be accurate, Rachel, as an explainer, but I'm not sure whether it doesn't let anyone off the hook in terms of, I don't know, being conscious programmers for a world in which intersectional justice is taken as not a nice to have, but a complete and utter necessity if anyone's interested in a just modern society where technology is rife in terms of our interaction with it.
Yeah, I completely disagree. I don't think it's just about the data. I mean, that is assuming that you have data and data reflects the world. And because the world is biased, the data will be biased. And then you have an algorithm that is put to work on that data, but the algorithm itself is neutral and objective. It's not. It has been modeled by a data scientist who will embed their worldview consciously or unconsciously into that algorithm. And even when you decide, okay, we're going to embed synthetic data within a data set in order to make it more fair, you are still modeling that on somebody's idea of what is objective and what is neutral. Above and beyond that, data scientists, because of the ubiquity of these technologies, because of how many people they affect, you've got to bear in mind that AI is used when it's efficient to use it, when you're dealing with a huge range of people and a huge market segment or whatever it might be, it's going to affect a lot of people. And so you need to be thinking about, what are the potential impacts of my data? What is the potential societal impacts of the way in which I'm using this data and the algorithm that I am putting to work on the data? So more and more, we are seeing ethical standards or legal standards being developed in various parts of the world that call upon companies and data scientists to think about and address and remedy the potential and actual social impact of their data use. Now, this has to be done both before it is put to work. So that's where you have the relevance of a broad and diverse team, because the bigger your team, with the bigger number, the more diverse your team, with the more diverse worldviews those people on the team have, the more able you are to think about how different people may be affected differently by something.
Okay, I want to bring Afshin back in here. That's fascinating. A partial disagreement from Rachel. Now, I don't want to lose my listeners here, so I'm going to try and keep it basic. But if my basic formulation of the issues are unhelpfully basic, please do push back, Afshin. Algorithm is another big word for some of us. I think of it in these terms, simplistically, that you have a formula and you plug it into some sort of system and then you put data into your formula.
Correct.
And there will be an outcome after the formula is applied to the data.
Correct.
And Rachel's critique to you, which sounds compelling to me logically, but I don't know whether it's factually true, is that you can't just talk about some data being unhygienic. Why are you not more conscious when you write the formula to try and preemptively make sure that you have a complex formula that is able to work a little bit more effectively with data that will have historical bias that is included in it? So the people who then write the formula or the algorithms, you are letting them off the hook.
Many of the algorithms have got their roots in stats. And many of these algorithms or statistical formulas have probably been around for about probably even over 100 years. So they aren't new. These new AI systems use these existing algorithms, although data scientists do have the ability to write new algorithms. Many of them use existing algorithms that have been around for many, many years. So it's not the algorithm that's inherently biased. In fact, in many cases, the algorithm doesn't care whether it's right or wrong. It's a world that's biased and the data that's biased.
Mm.
So it's not surprising when we receive biased results.
Mm.
The algorithm simply mirrors human behavior that's in the data. The AI or the algorithm actually doesn't care.
Mm.
It purely makes logical decisions based on the data that it has been provided with.
So in that ecosystem, Afshin, who should take ethical responsibility for results that come out of an algorithm that perpetuate past patterns of biases in society?
It's up to the data scientist to make sure that the data is amended to correctly reflect the way society looks today.
And maybe that's where there is a meeting of minds, Rachel, between you and Afshin, is that perhaps what we need to do is do something that we don't often do in public and popular discussion, which is to elevate into the center of popular discussion the incredible amount of real power that folks with titles such as Chief Technology Officer really have in corporates.
Yeah, I mean, I had this talk last week with a group of chief analytic officers and chief data officers where I said to them, you have enormous power. And with power comes responsibility to act in ways that are fair and ethical.
How did they respond? Were they shocked?
Yeah, but I think the amount of discourse on this topic at the moment and the resultant kind of legal and ethical frameworks that are being developed that are calling for greater company and business responsibility to act within their sphere of influence. I think it wasn't a surprise, but there was a lot of pushback in terms of what is the extent to which we can do good, so to speak. And I think that that's a different question. And we can get into that. But what I want to just jump back to this notion of the algorithm, because I still want to just explain how it may not be completely neutral or where there may be problems within the algorithm.
Okay, we'll explore that in a second because I want to give you a full opportunity. You know, we're learning a lot and I think it's really fascinating. You've listened to the conversation so far. You and I often speak about bias and interpersonal relations, bias in terms of how we might operate when we interview people in the world of work. We often speak about technology, but we have seldom married those two themes. What comes up for you as you listen to Afshin and to Rachel? And have you got questions for them as experts about ways in which artificial intelligence and machine learning can reproduce past biases in society? Really, really fascinating. You're also welcome to agree or disagree with them. Alternatively, or if you just have a question to deepen your own understanding, give us a call on 011-883-0702.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 for the curious.
26 minutes before 11 o'clock. If you've just joined us, we're in the middle of a fascinating conversation. Welcome, welcome, welcome to it. We're talking about biases within artificial intelligence and machine learning. With the help of Dr. Rachel Adams, who's at the University of London, and also Dr. Afshin Bachu, who is a Chief Technology Officer for PPC Insurance. We'll come back to algorithms in a second, and I won't forget that you wanted to say a bit more about it, Rachel, but let's engage the public a little bit. Chris in Sandton, thank you so much for calling in.
Hi, Yubi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks for holding.
I'm fantastic. Great topic, great show. I feel like this is the open land for the fourth industrial revolution. Anyway, Yubi, what I wanted to say actually was, it's quite interesting that personally I feel like data governance or data rules, policies or frameworks are not really, how can I put it, are not really sort of like moving at the same pace as the technology itself. And I'd like to actually even give you a practical example if you guys don't mind doing this. If you open Google now and literally type in beautiful woman, the only thing you will see, Yubi, is white woman, blonde, blue eyes, skinny, right? So for me, if I understand the topic of today correctly, that for me is a somewhat of a bias. So I have I'm a recent dad. So if my son were to now, for some reason, take out a tablet and Google beautiful woman, he will get the most incorrect picture. Mm. And what's worrying as well is that, let's look at the people at the forefront, at the epicenter of creating algorithms, right? Mm-hmm. The algorithm is a set of rules that are man-made, right? Yep. So Afshin alluded earlier to say, no, it's data. Fine, I understand this is historical data, but that data is still basically being interpreted or analyzed by an algorithm, which is a set of instructions given by a human being.
But my understanding, and Rachel will explain why this is not enough of a defense, but to be fair on Afshin, the way I understood him, and I thought he was perfectly lucid, is that there isn't something inherently wrong with the formula written to search for beautiful women, i.e. the algorithm, but that the person who decided to only put white women's faces in there, in the inputs, they are the ones who are problematic, if they were a bit more committed to diversity, intersectional justice, then the exact same algorithm will give you the results that look like your daughter.
Yeah.
Conclusion, well, the algorithm isn't the problem. Input data is the problem. But that's okay. Me spinning for action. Well, you're not convinced by that.
No. It makes sense. I'm learning too as well.
Yeah. Now, I could be wrong. Rachel, you wanted to take issue with my tagging on from Afshin. Why is it not sufficient to say, but for problematic input data, the same algorithms could be a little bit more woke in the language of the young?
Okay, so the problem is, who do you hold accountable?
Yeah.
You can't hold the data accountable. So you can't hold them accountable. And with algorithms, we need to get into a slightly more technical space just to talk about deep learning, which is where, and Afshin can speak to this much better than I can, but what I'm getting at is where in the algorithmic processing did a particular data input lead to a particular biased output, and determining where that happened and what data led to what biased output is where the accountability lies. But where very often with deep learning, where you get this idea of the black box, which is this space in a kind of algorithmic processing where even the data scientists don't know what the algorithm is doing with the data at that point. Mm. Where do you hold somebody and how do you hold somebody accountable where a bias has occurred? So that's my issue, which is this issue of accountability.
I find it really, really interesting. Do you agree with the way in which Rachel is complicating the value chain, that we can't sort of chop it into two distinctions, data, algorithm, and that if we were to talk about things like deep learning, the accountability question becomes harder to settle?
If you look at the way AI works, AI is made up of a number of layers, and in the middle layer is data once again. The next layer is the algorithm, and all the algorithm does is that it finds the pattern in existing data and projects that pattern to another sample of data. So I still stand by my point that the issues are once again within the data. So if there's any biasness, it's still within that data set.
I have a conceptual question for you. I don't know whether it's technologically silly, but conceptually, is it possible for an analytics guru to write algorithms that have this deep learning capacity that is an algorithm that is capable of doing some interesting ideological work on the data that you put into the system?
Yes, it is possible.
So why don't you?
There are scientists that do that, but it's you need to be operating at a very high maturity level. And I don't think many of the data scientists have evolved to that level yet.
I hope they're not listening.
There's a lot of trial and error that's happening.
Yeah.
But like I said earlier...
Technical maturity or political maturity?
Probably a little bit of both. But once again, you have to consciously build those models and you have to consciously insert it into the data in order to get to that outcome.
Mm, that's really interesting. Yeah. Ronald, good morning. Thank you for calling in.
Hello, this is Ronald speaking. I'm a blind person, so I'm very interested in all of this. Now, we're talking about bias. I probably would be blamed for being biased. Now, you see this, because I could tell immediately I heard Rachel's voice. She was from Britain, just as she can probably tell I was originally from Scotland. So what I want to know is, I can remember when voice programs first came out, and they were terrible. I mean, they sounded like, you know, little green men from Mars.
Mm.
But now the ones I've got on my tablet, I mean, you can get them Chinese, any language in the world, and even you can adjust the the diction, the inflection, anything you like. You know, you, the speed and all that. How is that taken into account from someone that's writing these things? Like, for instance, someone might write a program that can tell me there's a door 10 paces ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
The next one will say there's a door 10 paces ahead of you, but 5 paces ahead of you there's a slight ditch or something in the way. Now how am I going to know which one I can trust? Because I don't want to end up in the ditch.
Very good question. Very good question, Afshin.
Look, the program will meet. The program will need to be specified and coded to work in that way. So that particular example will probably need lots of data with different scenarios where there are ditches and no ditches, and that will need to be fed into the system.
I would say it requires something else, and this is where Rachel keeps us on our social justice toes. Before we talk about the data you input that accurately surveys the geography, you need a coding expert that cares about Ronald not falling into a ditch, don't you? Which, he's not going to even embark on the journey of A, writing that code and then finding decent data.
Yeah. Agree with that point.
Yeah.
Agree,
Rachel?
Yeah, I just want to come into a broader point here, which is not just about the bias that's inherent in data, but this is coming back to what Ronald was saying, that the bias that's inherent in who the AI is developed for.
Yeah.
So this idea of voice programming is a really interesting one, because if you look at Siri and Alexa or Cortana or Bixby on your phone, yes, they're available in a whole load of languages, but they're not available in any local African languages. Yes, they can speak in a Scottish or a British or an Australian accent, but can they speak in a local Black South African accent? No. So these are kind of biases that are inherent in the embedded into the technology in terms of speaking for who this technology has been developed for. I think it's another important issue that we have to look at with regards to bias.
And that's why the question of who is in the system, Rachel, from the point of view of talent attraction and retention into IT and analytics broadly matter, in the same way in which, if to take a completely different analogy, more in my field, if only men are involved in writing stories in the creative industries, then of course you're going to get certain kinds of characters that are prevalent or absent in script writing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the people in the team make a huge difference. And there's been a lot of efforts to try and promote diversity within the AI and machine learning sector that is producing really interesting results. I think another way in which bias comes about, we spoke at the beginning about how very easily when we think about AI, we imagine this kind of autonomous robot that has been anthropomorphized in some way or another. And my own work is looking at how very often these robots that we imagine when we talk about AI are gendered female, and what the problems are with gendering these robots that are supposed to kind of do your dirty work and you can boss them around and tell them what to do. What the problems are of gendering them all female.
Okay, let's take a break there. We've got many more callers. You probably won't get through all of them. We'll try and squeeze in one or two more. A riveting conversation. And I never thought that an hour of what we call explainer journalism would be so fascinating about technology and biases.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702.
13 minutes before 11 o'clock, and with another 30 minutes left, if you want to squeeze in your question, make sure you call us right now on 011-883-0702. We are talking about artificial intelligence and machine learning and how bias throughout the value chains within these parts of the economy can really affect the ways in which technology perpetuate past forms of discrimination. Ajax, good morning.
Hi, Eusebius and your callers. I'm just calling with respect to artificial intelligence within even the banking sector across the globe. I'm aware, without a lot of detail, that there are projects that are using facial recognition to identify potential risks for banks and people that could potentially rob banks by looking and assessing their behavior using the facial recognition. And a lot of the data sets that they are using to build these algorithms to detect potential criminals is based off data sets that is representative of that population. Now, given that South Africa is predominantly black, are they building into those algorithms the notion that to be black means that you're a criminal or any of your traits that you possess as a black person automatically define you in that algorithm as a criminal or lead to other data set points that would make you to be a criminal? That's my first point.
Okay, it was a really interesting question. What do you think of that?
Look, I think it's a good question, and those considerations should be taken. When humans make decisions, they use more than just a brain. Humans have emotions, personalities, thoughts, beliefs, and free will that affects their decisions.
Mm.
And these attributes are also constantly evolving. So it's important to capture some of those thoughts and emotions into models and add them to the data sets. So they should happen. Whether they're actually happening, I can't answer that.
Do we know whether it happens, Rachel? Because we know that racial profiling is rife and often individual members, whether it be at airports, he talks about the caller, the financial services sector, make those judgment calls as human beings. But it's kind of easy to abdicate responsibility, as you say, to this nefarious thing that we anthropomorphize called the algorithm.
Yeah, I think this is when things could become really problematic, when you defer responsibility to a technology that ultimately you've taken a hand in shaping.
Yeah.
Facial recognition technologies have been shown world over to be really problematic and racially biased. So we need to treat them with such care here. Remember, they are programmed to read your body as a surface, to read you and your intentions and who you are on a surface level basis, which is inherently racist. This is inherently how racial technologies and racial profiling and racial discrimination and race itself came about, the reading of people by their surfaces and what they looked like. So facial recognition in the US has been shown to not be able to recognize, I think 50% of the time it's able to recognize your race and gender if you're black. And if you're white, it's 99% of the time. So it's hugely problematic in terms of racial bias. And then I believe what happened, and there's some contestation around this story, is one of the leading Chinese companies that are developing facial recognition technologies went to Zimbabwe and the Zimbabwe government and bought their biometric database of faces in order to train the Chinese facial recognition technologies on black faces. This is hugely problematic. Did the people in Zimbabwe know and consent to having their faces given to the Chinese to develop an algorithm that could better surveil and track them? No, not necessarily. So I think we also need to look at the broader issues of power and exploitation that go to a bigger geopolitical level too, that all come to play here.
I think in the time that's left, I want to redirect to where to from here. I'm going to start with you, Rachel, and then Afshin can also tag on to the exact same question for the both of you. There are many sectors of our economy, Rachel, where we have not considered the question of power and the question deeply of ethical responsibility in terms of not your intentions, as one of my callers obsessed about earlier, but the impact of the services that you provide, even if you have good intentions. How do we make sure that we have a new generation of folks who work within the tech space that are literate and committed to using their literacy around power and bias and all the other isms that have been implicated in this hour's conversation? Rachel?
So I think there's a couple of things. I think there need to be training programs and ethics training programs for people who develop algorithms and use data in ways that may have a material impact on people's lives. Secondly, we need to recognize that we do have frameworks here. We have the Constitution that calls on everybody, public or private sector, individual or government, to play their part in realizing and achieving the social transformation set out. So embedding those constitutional values in company policies on ethics and data, on the development of the Protection of Personal Information Act, which is a core piece of legislation for addressing biases and unfair discrimination that are a result of any kind of data processing. I think these are really important steps.
Mm. Afshan, same question to you.
My view is that many of these systems are built around models of humans. And we need to make sure that we expect the same, or we need to make sure that we have the same expectations of humans. And we need to ensure that humans are ethical and humans are unbiased. And if we don't expect the same from humans, how can we expect the same from AI?
And I would say, and I'm going to try and squeeze in one or two more calls, Lindy and Sean, just hold on. But what I would add on, and I think you this is what you were saying throughout, Rachel, and I'm trying to think of a simpler word than the massive anthropomorphizing. We must stop talking about AI as if it is a human being.
Yeah, I think as soon as we do that, we are allowing those data scientists to model what they see as a valuable human being or a valuable form of intelligence. Mm. So there's all sorts of problems there, and that's a kind of whole new and big discussion in and of itself, I think.
Lindy, thank you for your patience. What do you want to say? Thanks for calling in. Hello,
Hi.
Lindy.
Hi there. So I was just looking at when you guys were talking about biases and maybe diversifying the data scientists that are employed to feed such data to these AIs, right? There's a difference between getting Usbongile from the Lokshin to Usbongile who went to Harvard and the kind of information and data that they would then give to kind of assist in, I think maybe if the AI is targeted at a certain group, she might be assimilating to, I don't know, the more, I hate to say this, but the more colonized version of her education rather than looking at her ethnic background and saying, my people would be more prone to so forth. And like, if you're in the hood, this is what you would be looking for. And so biases also go in accordance to the kind of education that the data scientists have received, be it they black, white, or Indian or whatever.
Yes.
If themselves have been, to a certain extent, colonized or shifted slightly in their education and how they see the world, then it's kind of defeated when we say let's diversify the group of data scientists that we do involve.
I agree, Lindy. I wouldn't even put it in colonized terms. I think we can be more kind than that. All of us are susceptible to confirmation bias, other patterns of bias in our thinking and reasoning processes. And it's so fascinating in experimental psychology that even those who are experts on the subject are not immune to perpetuating the very biases that they are experts on when they speak about it dispassionately. So it's about a diverse set of experiences. And it's not only about race, it's about class, language, geography, accent bias. And as one caller reminded us earlier, ableism that we haven't even spoken about. So I think you're right about that. Sean, our final caller for today, what did you want to say?
Hi, Sirius. I'll try to squeeze this into 20 seconds. Just from your guess, first of all, do you think we will hit the singularity or achieve AGI? And if we do, if you listen to Elon Musk, Sam Harris, all the top intellectuals, they're always warning us about this. Don't reach AGI or the singularity. The bias against us as humans will be overwhelming and could spell the end for our species. I just want to find out from your guests if they would agree with that concept or not.
That's a lovely, scary question to end on. I get the spirit of it. I do not know directly what AGI or singularity is. Afshan, tell us, what is Sean worried about there and should he be?
I think Sean is worried about robots taking over the world. And the reality is that if you build AI systems that are a perfect reflection of humans, and taking into account that humans are not always ethical, you'll have a case where AI thinks for itself, and then we'll slowly try and take over the world.
Hmm. You can have the final say, Rachel. 20 seconds.
Okay, I think the singularity is something that we should try very hard not to get to. We shouldn't vest too much power in AI. We need to remember the humans. And we also need to consider the idea of this singularity and this post-humanism as being based on this assumption that everyone has had a chance to be fully human. There's biases embedded there, and we need to interrogate that.
Hmm. Dr. Rachel Adams, University of London and Research Specialist at the Human Sciences Research Council here, and also to Dr. Afshin Bachu, who's a specialist in this stuff, doctoral studies in IT architecture, but Chief Technology Officer at PPC Insurance. Thank you for making Nerdishness so much fun.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on air.
Thank you.